And good morning and welcome to this June 28th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. I'm excited this morning to welcome back Thridi Umregard to the show. She is joining me now. In the second half, I'll chat with novelist Elizabeth Kostovo about her latest novel, The Shadowland. So let's get on with Thridi.
Thridi Umregard is the author of six novels, The Story Hour, The World We Found, The Weight of Heaven, The Space Between Us, If Today Be Sweet, and Bombay Time, and the memoir First Darling of the Morning. She was on the show with me in 2012 and 2014 for her past two novels. You can find interviews of those up on our website, available via podcast. Thridi is the Armington Professor of English at Case Western University and a journalist for nearly 20 years. She's the winner of the Nieman Fellowship for Harvard, and was a 2006 finalist for the Penn Beyond Margins Award. Her latest is Everybody's Son. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Thridi, welcome back.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you so much for having me.
I love having you on. Every time you have a new book out, I rush to call your publicist. So this is always a huge treat, and I love the book.
That's very sweet.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a chance to talk about Everybody's Son, kind of where it came from, your inspirations for it, and kind of take us into Anton's world a little bit.
Yeah, so the basic storyline is that when the book opens, it's 1991, and young Anton has been locked up in a hot apartment by his mom while she's gone out looking for drugs. She's supposed to come home in just, you know, a couple of hours. Instead, she stays away for 7 days, and the boy finally frees himself and, of course, lands in custody of the state, in another part of town, much more affluent white part of town. There's a youngish couple, well, not that young, they're in their early 40s, I guess, David and Dolores Coleman. And David is really political royalty. I mean, he comes from a long, distinguished family of senators and people like that. And he and his wife had lost their own biological son 5 years prior to when the book opens, and they have decided to become foster parents. So they take Anton in, and soon after, David really, really begins to enjoy Anton's company, but also realizes what potential this boy has and how that potential could be realized if he were permanently removed from, you know, being returned back to his mom and placed with them permanently. And he basically uses his influence to make that happen. And the rest of the book basically follows Anton growing up. So we meet him at age 9 and follow him for the next 15 or 20 years. Until he becomes a political figure in his own right. But the book then becomes about how all these different characters who have been affected by David Coleman's decision to permanently keep Anton in his life, what impact that has on all the different characters, the consequences of this one action. And it's also a book about identity and racial identity, and Anton having to figure out his way in the world and decide who he belongs to, and hence the title, Everybody's Son. Is it possible to be everybody's son, or do you have to choose your parents, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Where did the kernel of the idea come from? How did this start?
Well, that's an interesting question in that this book, I'm sort of at a loss for words. I mean, to describe how suddenly and how completely this book presented itself to me, I saw the entire book, plot, characters, names of characters, all of it, in a span of about 30 seconds. I was going about my daily life, minding my own business, and suddenly this book decided to visit me And I knew the story really, really well, almost as if I was reading the book rather than this was a book that, you know, had not yet been written. So I'm not exactly sure, although I have to say that, you know, I started working on this book about, it's probably been two years ago. And, you know, this was when Black Lives Matter was very ascendant, very much in the news. This was in the waning years of the Obama presidency. So, you know, the first black president, all those things were kind of swirling in the air. And so I'm sure I did what all writers do, which is just absorb the things that were floating all around me. So I'm sure that the book, what feels like a gift from the gods, this sudden inspiration, I'm sure had its roots in a more grounded reality.
Have you ever had that experience before of something coming to you so fully formed?
Not exactly to this extent, although I have to say that I'm one of those writers who, once I sort of conceive of an idea for a book, I kind of know the narrative arc of the book fairly soon after. Huh. You know, I kind of at least know the ending to the book much before I sit down to actually type it out. So in some sense, I've had a taste of this, but not quite in the manner that this book came to me.
What a gift.
I feel like
writers sit around waiting for this forever.
I should be careful not to say this in the company of writers, because they might begin to hate me.
No, they'll claw your eyes out. No.
Yeah, right.
Well, you raise an interesting point that I wanted to talk about, which is the political climate under which the book was written versus the political climate under which the book is being born into and coming out. And those are two very different things. And I think that's very interesting. And so I wonder what your reactions are to that when you were writing this, the world was one way and it kind of shifted under our feet, maybe unexpectedly for some of us, maybe not so unexpectedly for others, but that the book is coming into, just a different place than where it's originated.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, right? There's no question that the political reality has shifted. And yet, I would venture to say that the issues that this book deals with, you know, white privilege, the abuse of power, racial disparities, racial relations, the quest for identity, specifically the quest for racial identity, I dare say that those issues are, sadly, more or less timeless, you know. Almost since the founding of the Republic, with, you know, exaggerating a little bit, but, these have been issues that we as a country have been grappling with. And the forms change and the names of the characters change, but the issues more or less remain the same. So in that sense, I don't know that the reception of the book is going to be informed so very much by how, as you put it so eloquently, the ground has shifted below our feet, under our feet, in the last 6 months. I think the book sort of steps beyond, even though it was born in the crucible of these political things that were happening 2 years ago, I don't feel like the issues are all that different than what they were 2 years ago or what they'll be 2 years hence.
Right. I mean, I really think one thing this country needs to talk about is race and to not flinch from the hard conversations, because we obviously haven't come as far as some of us thought. And I just think people are scared of these conversations or tired of these conversations or angry about these conversations or emotions. Yeah. I can't even guess.
Defensive about these conversations. Absolutely. I mean, it's like, it's the classic, if I don't think about it, if I don't deal with it, maybe it'll just go away and it won't exist, you know? There's a kind of childishness, if you will, a national childishness when it comes to just once and for all dealing with the issue of race. And I think for some people, there's this genuine fear that if I acknowledge a problem, if I acknowledge the pain and suffering that so many of our fellow citizens experience really every single day of their lives, that if I acknowledge that, then I have to be responsible for it, then I have to fix it. And that feels so overwhelmingly big for people. And, you know, from a purely human point of view, you know, it's easy to talk about white privilege and class privilege and all these things. The fact is, most people don't look at themselves, don't look at their own bodies, don't look at their own lives, and consider themselves to be privileged. You know, that is, in fact, the essence of white privilege, is that it can go unrecognized, even while the person who experiences it is indulging in it, you know. And so I'm sympathetic, frankly, to people who just say, enough, I just don't want to think about these issues anymore. It's too big, it's too hard, I'm just one person. What difference does it make? What difference can I make? But while that's understandable from an individual point of view, I think it's extremely dangerous that we have never had that national conversation. And frankly, anymore, and this is where your question, your last question about the current political climate comes into play, I don't even know what that conversation would look like today, and how we could have that conversation without, you know, great outbursts of anger and perhaps even bloodshed.
Well, I think one of the answers might be through fiction, because it's less confrontational, it's less direct. You can empathize with all of these characters and what they, you know, went through. And so somebody can find themselves in all of these characters in the book and empathize with them. And maybe that's a way to start having this conversation, is through kind of the, I don't want to say the safety of fiction, but it is, it does feel kind of safe, because it's one step removed from me personally, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think certainly that's part of the reason why I read, and it's certainly, you know, a large measure why I write. I feel more and more that everything in our society today is so polarized, it's so fragmented, you know, whether we're talking about certainly politics, my God, but even if we're talking about media or the kind of music that people listen to, we don't even all listen to the same music anymore, you know, and social media and technology has certainly made that kind of fragmentation possible. And some people love that. But I feel like the one thing that we still have is literature, is fiction. You know, we can all read, if not the same book, you know, most good literature teaches us one thing, and that's empathy. It's compassion. It's the ability to transcend our own skin and step into somebody else's skin for a few hours. And I, to me, more than anything else, more than the beauty of language, more than, you know, a well-crafted story, that to me is the number one achievement of a good novel.
Right. As you were writing this, I'm wondering about this question of race, and if you grappled with that, of how you knew you were going far enough, or if you ever felt like you were going, I don't know what it means to go too far in fiction. I don't think you can, but if it felt like you didn't want to be preachy about any point of view you might have, or just the ways in which we talk about race and in fiction, and if that presented any issues for you as a writer.
You know, honestly, I just had sort of one guiding principle, if you will, when I wrote this book, and that was to point out the complexity of human life and human relations. And going along with that, to make the reader realize that there really are, this is not a book about, you know, good guys versus bad guys or, you know, white racist versus, you know, exploited black woman. I mean, I didn't want any kind of lazy writing in this book. I didn't want to indulge in those tired, lazy tropes. What I wanted to do was really mix it up and point out just the amazing complexity of human life. You know, David Coleman does this rather awful thing, but he does it with the best of intentions. And don't we, can't we all recognize ourselves in that? We may not go as far as he does, but the human capacity for self-delusion is universal, I think, you know? And what I wanted to do was write a book where the reader kind of vacillates between, you know, the different characters. You know, is David right? Is Anton ultimately better served by being raised by this educated, you know, professional, affluent family? Or would he have been better off living with his mother? You know, that's the central question in the book. And I didn't want to present any easy answers. I wanted, in effect, Marie, I wanted the reader to struggle with the answer to that question in much the same way that Anton does.
Right, right. I guess the flip side of this question of race, and what I really appreciated about this book and what I think a lot of new writers I've talked to struggle with, is this issue of authority. And I think it's something new writers worry about. They worry about, do I, as a white woman or, you know, an Eskimo man, have the authority to tell a black man or a transgender woman's story? And fiction writers do that all the time. It's their job. But I feel like when it comes to race, people start to get worried and they start to ask themselves, do I have the authority to tell this story? And I just think it's important to give people the comfort of saying you have whatever the necessary empathy is in you to, you know, to take on somebody else's story. I wonder if that question of authority ever comes up either in your head or in conversations with your students, or and kind of how you get around it.
Yeah, it of course it does. It always does. And I might add that it's not just new writers who have this fear and who explore this issue of authority. For me, what I decided early on was, you know, if people can, you know, if science fiction writers can write about space aliens and UFOs, if men can write about women and the other way around, surely I have the right and the authority to write a book and tell a story about what I consider to be the most quintessential American story, which is race. You know, it's the most quintessential American issue that we have been grappling with for hundreds of years. So basically, the way I answered the question of authority was twofold. One was simply to claim that authority for myself as a fellow human being who ought to be able to, by God, if you're going to call yourself a novelist, again, the first tool of the trade that you have is empathy, is to put yourself in somebody else's place. If you can't do that, just pack up your notebook and, you know, go home, turn off the computer. So that's part of it. But the second half of what I would say is, ultimately, you know, the identity of the writer doesn't really matter. What truly matters is the work itself. The book has to either stand or fall on its own two feet. So for anybody who's concerned about somebody with my ethnic background writing about, you know, a white family and a black family, all I would say to them is, you know, read the book.
Yep.
After you're done reading the book, see if you still have the question of authority and whether it was any of my business to wade into these waters, you know? And judge the book the way you would judge any other book. You know, are the characters credible? Is the dialogue good? Is the plot line interesting? Is it realistic? In other words, judge this book in the way you would any other work of fiction.
Great answer. Great answer. My guest this morning is Thridi Umargar. The book is Everybody's Son. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. And the book is really as much about class as it is about race. And I think in some ways, that's just as difficult for Americans to talk about. We were having this conversation on the show last week that Americans are threatened by people, maybe everybody is, maybe it's a human thing, but threatened by people who switch classes and who either, you know, kind of claw their way out of whatever lower class they're in or whatever happens. And this book was as much about that as it was anything. And I don't know if those became intertwined issues in your head or if you thought about class as a separate issue than race.
If the two were intertwined in my head, it's only because they're intertwined in real life.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, race is just a convenient shorthand that we have developed in this country to talk or not talk about class. The fault lines in this country have fallen in such a way that race is an easier, more obvious, more physically manifested form of class divides, right? It's an easier thing to identify than necessarily identifying class difference. But to me, this book, if you really want to know the truth, it's not all that different than any other novel that I've written. Even though this is my first novel that has no Indian characters and or is not set in India. But to me, this book is simply an exploration of power and power differences between two very different people. And every single book that I've written in some way deals with that kind of division, is an exploration of power in one way or the other. So, good for you for noticing what, frankly, most other interviewers have not, which is it is very much a book about class differences.
You just answered my other question, which was, because this is your seventh novel, can you look across all of your works and see issues that continue to plague you? And I think you're exactly right. They are all about power and the different ways it manifests itself. Do you see other similarities across your books? Themes that don't leave you alone, questions that you continually come back to in fiction?
Well, if it's not too self-serving an answer, which it well might be, what I'd like to believe is that this book does what I've tried to do in other work, and I've already talked about this in some measure, which is that I'm really not interested in building characters who are sort of simplistic and one-dimensional. I really like to write about people who are both, you know, angels and devils, who are just recognizably human, you know. I've certainly written about gender disparities in other work. I've written about sort of the kind of cultural and interpersonal misunderstandings that arise between different groups of people, but also within individuals in the same family, you know, between husband and wives, for instance, or children and parents. So those are some of the parallels that I see. But, you know, I think if you took a poll of 100 books, you could probably find some of these themes in 98 of those 100 books.
Right.
So I don't think it's something that's unique necessarily to my books.
Yeah. Who gave you the most trouble in this book amongst the cast of characters? Somebody that either you had a hard time figuring out or, you know, you just had to grapple with their inner life a little more than the others?
Yeah, great question. The book sort of wrote itself. I have to say that I struggled much much less with this book than I did with my last one, The Story Hour, because, you know, the Indian woman in that novel, as you may recall, Marie, talks in this kind of weird, half, you know, broken, ungrammatical English, and getting her voice down made me sweat like no other character ever has. But you're asking me about this book. So I would say perhaps Corrine, yeah, who paradoxically is my favorite character in this book. Corrine, of course, is Anton's college girlfriend, this very self-possessed, militant, black African-American fellow student who really, really pushes Anton, you know, who is basically an unformed person at that time during their undergrad days. And Corrine, in some ways, I mean, I just really love her as a character because she's so self-righteous in the way that young people are, and she's so full of herself. And how politics are good, but she can also be a little obnoxious, you know, in how blatantly and baldly she states them. And the risk with Corrine, of course, was to tone her down enough so that she didn't become some kind of a caricature, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't want her to be silly. She is a serious person. She's well-intended. She means to do good in the world. And let's face it, people like that can often, at least on the written page, can become sort of cartoonish. And it was very important to me to make sure that she avoided that fate.
She's definitely the most memorable character. It's funny that you, I mean, maybe it's not funny that you say her, I'm not surprised, but she does have a larger than life quality relative to the number of pages she's, you know, time she's on the page.
Yeah,
she's
right.
Big, you know, she's big in the book.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you can see her outfits and you can hear her talk, and you know, she's she's wonderful.
Yeah, she ends up playing a strange role in the novel, I think, in that she becomes a kind of spiritual guide to Anton, even years later, you know, after she's no longer in his life. I mean, she really shapes him in a way as much as any of his other, or I should say, in a way, as much as any of his parents do.
Right,
you know?
Right. Loved her. We're about out of time, but I wonder if you can leave us with some writerly advice, maybe not from this book, because I don't know that too many writers are going to get the gift of a novel fully formed in their head. But the other six novels that you've written, are there things that sustain you, things that, you know, I feel like writers come back to a blank page every time and they say it's like starting over again, but you've got to have something in your toolkit to get you through the next one.
I think off the top of my head, what I would say is, I think before you start a book, you may not know the whole book. You may not know how it's going to end. You may not know what the characters are going to do. And that's fine. I mean, that's what writing is. It's a process of discovery of those things. I do think the thing that you, that would be helpful to know is to know why you're writing this particular book. You know, what is it that you want to say in this book? What is the takeaway that you would like the reader to have? I'm not talking about something as sort of childish as, you know, moral of the story. That's not what we're talking about here. But books exist for a reason. And sometimes, I see this in student work, sometimes, you know, books just end up being vanity projects, you know, but there's no real reason for this particular book to exist. And I think it always helps if the writer has a good sense of why this particular book in this particular moment in time. Why are they going to invest the next several years of their lives on this particular project? To me, that's sort of the spine of a book, that sense of purpose that a book serves.
Mm-hmm.
What are the wide thematic issues that you want to grapple with on the page? I think that's crucial for a writer to know.
I love talking to you. That was wonderful.
I love talking to you. Can I honestly tell you without, if you know me at all, I'm not somebody who's given to flattery at all. You ask the best questions. I mean, honestly, I've done a lot of interviews already with this book, and God, I mean, you've asked questions today that really made me think. Oh, so thank you for
that's really kind. That's really kind. I can't wait for the next one. I'm on your list.
It's going to be a sequel.
Oh, good. Yet another question I didn't have time to ask is if these characters have left you alone, and I'm glad they haven't. That's great.
Well, no, it's not a sequel to this book.
It's not a sequel to this
Space Between Us.
Oh, no, gotcha. No. Gotcha. Well, that's also wonderful. That's also wonderful.
Yeah. Thridium. See you same time next year.
I love it. Thank you so much. That was Thridium Regard. The book is everybody's son. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
We are going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Elizabeth Kostova will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, Pen on Fire, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Elizabeth Kostova is the author of three novels, The Historian, The Swan Thieves, and The Shadowland. The Historian, as you will recall, was the first debut novel in U.S. publishing history to debut at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It has been translated into 40 languages and won the Quill and Independent Booksellers Award. The Swan Thieves was also a New York Times bestseller and has been translated into 28 languages. Her short fiction, poetry, and essays have appeared in such periodicals and anthologies as the Mississippi Review, Poets and Writers, The Best American Poetry, Michigan Quarterly, elsewhere. Elizabeth has taught in programs across the United States, as well as on the Bulgarian Black Sea. She reads and lectures internationally and is the co-founder of the Elizabeth Kostova Foundation, which provides competitive opportunities for Bulgarian writers and translators, as well as opportunities for native English writers to travel to Bulgaria. Her latest is The Shadowland. It's published by Ballantine, which is a division of Random House. It will drive our discussion this morning. My huge pleasure to welcome her on. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. This is a treat. So before I give you a chance to introduce the book, I want to first give you an opportunity to talk about your connection to Bulgaria, because I feel like that really lies at the foundation of this book, and I know you have a long and historied relationship with that country. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd love to. It's one of my favorite topics, actually. I first went to Bulgaria in 1989. To study traditional folk music there, and by total coincidence, I arrived there about 7 days after the Berlin Wall fell. So it was an amazing time to be there, and I learned a lot there. I loved the country. While I was there, I met my future husband, and I've been going back for 28 years.
Amazing. So how long were you physically living there?
Well, that first time I was there for 6 months.
6 months, okay.
And since, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then
so
your
I had
husband
a good opportunity to really put down some roots.
Yeah. It, you know, that country strikes me as a lot of the countries that were behind the Berlin Wall just strike me as so mysterious. And I wonder if you found that kind of penetrating their psyche and getting into the getting into the people's lives and minds and what that process might have been like.
Well, it's been profoundly moving for me to try to write about this country that is so mysterious to us in the West in a lot of ways. And it was kind of a fly in amber behind the Berlin Wall. Since then, of course, it's become a very globalized country, although it remains a small country and one we don't tend to travel to as much. But it's a beautiful country. It's got amazing landscapes and very interesting, incredibly dense, and sometimes very dark history. And I've also noticed that people there are just, they're incredibly hospitable often, and they've lived through a lot of hardship, and they are very thoughtful people. So, yes, it's been a kind of an amazing experience for me to try to somehow encapsulate that in some writing.
Yeah, yeah. So take us into the Shadowland and into Alexandra's life, and kind of what got the novel off the ground, your point of entry for the novel, and introduce us to this world.
Well, the writing the Shadowland has been quite an experience. I worked on it over about 8 years, and I traveled back to Bulgaria a lot to do research for it and learn more for it. And in a nutshell, it's the story of a young American woman. She's in her late 20s. Her name is Alexandra. And in 2008, she goes to this very chaotic post-communist world of Bulgaria. And she knows nothing really about the country or the language or the history. She's just gone there partly to teach and partly for an odd reason that we find out early in the narrative, but I won't spoil that part. And she's been in the country for an hour when she finds herself helping an elderly couple and their middle-aged son get into a taxi cab with all their baggage because she's a helpful young American. And in the process, she accidentally keeps a piece of their baggage, a small black bag. And she realizes this only too late when they've disappeared into the city. And when she opens this bag, she discovers that it contains an urn of human ashes with just a name and Cyrillic letters on the outside. Of course, she doesn't know who they are or where they've gone or what the life of this person she now holds might have been. And as any of us would be in that situation, she's pretty horrified and trying to figure out how to do the right thing. So The Shadowland is really the story of her journey into Bulgaria and also into the past of the family whom she's come into contact with in this very startling way.
Yeah, so good. So what was the door into the novel? Did it start with this image of the ashes for you? Did it start with Alexandra's character? Talk a little bit about what the kernel was that opened this novel up for you.
You know, it was really a remarkable experience, and it's something I don't expect to have happen ever again in my writing life. But I was thinking very hard about writing a book about Bulgaria. And I had all this great material from visiting there over the years and reading a lot and knowing people there and interviewing people. And I kept trying to find my way into that material without much success, just mentally thinking about it over years. And I even thought about writing a nonfiction book, a kind of a travel memoir book about Bulgaria to use this material, but that didn't seem quite right either. And to be honest, I woke up very early one morning from a dream about 8 years ago now, in which I had seen a young American woman finding this, you know, accidentally keeping this piece of baggage. And then I in the dream, I really understood this dream was a novel in that strange logic that dreams have. I knew even there that I was looking at my new novel. And that I didn't know these people, that they were characters. And I saw her journey through Bulgaria through the middle of this book. I'm sorry to say I did not see any chapter summaries that would have taken far less time to write the book if I had seen those. But I saw the journey that would take her through this country she knows nothing about. And then I saw the climax of the book, the almost ending, which is, you know, in my dream it was a very dramatic scene as well. And I woke up just electrified by it and sat right down and wrote down everything I could remember and went on to work on that dream for those 8 years. And, of course, part of the joy of writing fiction is that there are surprises. So other things came along into the story that I hadn't dreamed or hadn't expected. But for the most part, I really stuck to that story that I got sleep. So that was quite a gift. I don't really expect to get a second one of those, but it was wonderful.
That is quite a gift. It's so funny because if our listeners listen only to this show today, they're going to get the impression that writing is the easiest thing, because Thridi Umargar describes something very similar. She's like, the book really just wrote itself. I'm like, man, how often does that happen?
If only that happened more often, yeah.
Right, right. We'll be all waiting around for that that muse to strike, which it so rarely does. So,
well, you know, having that experience actually made me wonder how many novels we missed by not waking up in time.
Right, right. How many novels I could write just about doing the dishes, which is what I dream about.
Right, exactly.
That's great. So, and the structure of this novel is really pretty complicated. I mean, we move back and forth in time, we move back and forth in place, and I was wondering if you could, and it's an expansive novel, if people see it in the bookstore, you know, it's close to 500 pages. And it always strikes me for novelists, the key to keeping that big structure in your head and kind of what your office looks like to keep things straight and to keep times and places straight. Can you talk a little bit about structuring the novel and how you organize it?
Sure. You know, that really was, that's something that fascinates me with every book I write or read. And in the case of The Shadowland, I found one of the most helpful things was to have a huge map of Bulgaria up on my office wall, because this book is a journey, among other things. And although some of the place names are fictionalized or changed, they reflect real places and real research and real travel. And it's such a gorgeous, varied country, the landscapes of Bulgaria. So I kept this great big image of Bulgaria as a map right in front of me during most of the writing of the book. And that helped me structure it at kind of a deep level. Of course, you know, on the practical level, I had a lot of outlining to do, a lot of notes. I had a few times when I was writing the internal story, which goes back to 1940 and forward through the history of communism. Communism came to Bulgaria partly in the form of the Soviet army in 1944 in a pretty brutal way, and kept the country closed, as you know, until 1989. So for 45 years, there was very, very little coming and going to the outside world. So a few times when I was writing the internal story, which goes back into the communist history of Bulgaria, I just stopped everything else and wrote my way through that story. And in the book, you'll find that kind of broken up and alternated with the contemporary story. Mm-hmm. But I felt that I needed to stay in that world in a kind of continuous way for a while. Right. In terms of research and writing. And that was one of the most moving parts of writing this book, that history of what ordinary people went through in a totalitarian regime. And so I did stop and write the kind of the core of the book for a while and then go back and restructure it.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that and about the research, because in the first half hour, we were also talking about this question of authority. And I think for writers wishing to tackle a foreign place and or a foreign time, I would love to hear at what point you felt like you had command over Bulgaria enough to write about it, and what it kind of took in terms of spending time on the ground, spending time talking to the people, spending time with research, that you felt like you kind of had your arms around this enough to write a novel about it.
It's very daunting. I mean, I think anybody who approaches writing about another culture without a pretty good dose of fear and humility is probably in trouble, because it is very much an outsider's point of view, and there's so much we can't know or need to be respectful of as writers with another culture. And I didn't grow up in Bulgaria. I have no ethnic connection to it even. And although I've visited off and on for 28 years, as I mentioned, that still means I'm very much an outsider. And my way into this story, which my dream helped me solve, was to bring an outsider in. Mm-hmm. So as a reader, that you really travel with Alexandra and you experience things that are strange to her, that are new to her, that she doesn't necessarily understand. And, of course, she acquires some friends and guides and people who interpret this world for her, but ultimately she's having her own experience of it. And that I did feel comfortable with because I have been an outsider there and a traveler reacting with wonder or fascination or frustration to a new world there. And the harder part for me was the internal story, which concerns the family she gets mixed up with, and this very, well, traumatic experience they have with a totalitarian machine. Mm-hmm. And for that, I did a lot of research. I read a lot of oral histories taken from people who experienced what my main character in that part of the book experiences. And I have a lot of friends and family there, many of whom are older and have conveyed different parts of that experience to me, not necessarily the one that's exactly in the book, but have lived through the time that my characters lived through in the internal story. So I did a lot of reading. I talked with people. I went back to places that I wanted to write about, and of course I was going back 50 years, 60 years, 70 years after the fact, but I wanted to see the things that lasted. And one of the most powerful moments I had in writing and researching the book was on some research travel I was doing there. About halfway through writing the book, I unexpectedly got permission to go into the ruins of a labor camp from communist times in a very kind of shut down, rather secret location in Bulgaria. And Bulgaria had a lot of labor camps under communism, as most of the East Bloc did, and they were built on the Soviet model. And a lot of people got caught in them, many of them for very trivial reasons. Some of them because of political dissent, and almost all of them without trial and unfairly. And it was really a strange experience to go to these ruins. They were not memorialized. There's very little memorializing of those camps, so it's not like visiting a museum. There are not many plaques. You have to kind of know what happened there to understand where you are. And as I was standing in this place, I felt it was not simply a haunted kind of place, but terribly empty, just drained of humanity, as if that spot of earth had lost all its meaning, because I knew some of what had happened there. And at that moment, I realized this really has to be part of this book, this big book I've been working on and struggling to make so real. This is part of it. Mm-hmm. So that brought in a whole new dimension for me, and a great feeling of responsibility too. I felt very strongly that I didn't want to use real people's exact experience, for example, from the oral histories I was reading, because those sufferings belong to people, a few of whom are still alive, but certainly a lot of their children are alive still, or younger members of their families. So I've tried to be very respectful of their real experience, but to give a really intensely, historically accurate detail of setting and events and things that that did happen in general to people there.
So interesting. I think it's always interesting to talk about the world that a book is born into. I do a lot of that, you know, I ask authors a lot about that on the show, that this book has a lot of political relevance for what we're living through now, and what we had thought was maybe ancient history and maybe we had learned from is rearing its head again, and what a politically relevant novel this is for our time. And I was wondering if in the experience of writing this, you had kind of that awareness of how relevant it might be, or if it sort of felt like reporting on a historical time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've thought about it a lot. It's such an interesting question. I do feel this book is extremely relevant to our time, and I'm sorry that it is.
Yeah. Right.
But I think that we are in a period worldwide and very strongly in our own country and culture of thinking about how easily a totalitarian state can be established anywhere.
Yeah.
This was something that happened really fast in Bulgaria. It was an agrarian parliamentary monarchy, you know, 5 minutes before it became first a kind of anarchist situation, and then very, very rapidly a totalitarian government. And I thought about that a lot while I was writing the book, because I've always felt, you know, you study enough history and you feel the dangers of repetition, as the famous phrase goes. But I had no idea that by the time I published it, we would be struggling so hard in our own country with issues of constitutionality, with issues of surveillance, state surveillance, with this feeling of panic and danger that I think any thinking person is grappling with right now. And it's clear that in a society where we've neglected people tremendously at the same time, there's always this kind of terrible fertile ground for nationalism, for totalitarianism, for power grab. So I don't mean this just as a kind of, you know, intellectual sitting in an ivory tower saying, gee, let's not repeat history. I think we also have had a terribly neglectful society where people have been and become very impoverished in so many ways and disdained. And so now, you know, we're in part reaping the awful fruits of that. So I really feel that we are in a situation where we have to watch our government awfully carefully. And I've been very proud to be part of the protest against a lot of what's happening right now politically. And at the same time, I think we need so much to look at our priorities as a society and the way we have just let so many basic human needs drain away from so many people. So it's very sad to work on a book like this and then see all of this unfolding in your own country. But I found when I went on my book tour, first book tour for this recently, traveling really all over the country, I found that the discussion was alive and well. And I'm really glad to be a tiny part of that big, very serious conversation we're having now as a society.
Yeah, I mean, if anything good has come of this disaster, I do think it's that. And our country is so young, and I think we all, in our hubris, thought that we were immune from all of these things that all of these other countries have gone through. And, you know, to have a little bit of a wake-up call is probably not all bad. I have 100 other things to ask you, and we're out of time. But I guess the answer is to read the book. The answer is to read The Shadowland, and it's... and it's just wonderful. Is there a piece of advice, writing advice, that you can leave us with for our writing listening audience?
Well, my piece of advice to myself always is just to read and read and read, and to read the things we most admire and most want to emulate, and to make that just a part of our daily food. I was so inspired reading a lot of history for this book, but also reading some great novels. And I think, including Conrad and Dickens, and I just go back to those models over and over for inspiration.
Yeah. It's so funny how many people say Dickens. Every time I've asked recently, like, Dickens is really having a resurgence. Every time I've asked people, like, I read Dickens, I'm like, man, everybody's reading Dickens. It's great.
Yeah, it's great. I'm so happy about that. Yeah, he's really he was a master plotster, plotcraft person.
Yeah.
But also so great at describing people, and that, you know, that's a whole other conversation, because Dickens is also controversial in so many ways.
Yeah.
But I do draw a lot of sustenance from reading 19th century prose.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, many do. Elizabeth Kosovo, mm-hmm. This is really wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much. What a great conversation to be able to have with you.
Thank you. Thank you. You too. The book is The Shadowland. It is out. It is published by Ballantine. It is wonderful. Elizabeth Kosovo, you can find her online. She has a wonderful website and obviously two other really wonderful novels. So check her out. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Kaleidoscope Days coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.